Hi, everybody. It's Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies. And my guest today is Scott Cooper. Scott Cooper has just made a little film, maybe not such a little film, one of the better films of the year called Black Mass with Johnny Depp and an amazing cast. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Maltin. What a pleasure to be here.
Oh, please call me Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.
Everybody does. I'm very happy to have you here because you're not only a filmmaker, writer, director, you have been an actor, but you're also a movie buff. And that's what we really crave on this show, is people who love to talk about movies.
Well, when you grow up in small town Virginia with one movie theater, you often are introduced to the world at large through cinema. Mm-hmm. And if you're really lucky, through world cinema, because Virginia, and at least the small town in where I'm from, you often aren't exposed to Japan, Iran, France. So it was through the eyes of Sajid Ray or through Kurosawa or Jean-Pierre Melville, among many others, that I got to see the world. So if not for cinema, who knows where I would be.
Hmm. What drew you into acting?
Well, I grew up in a small town called Abingdon, Virginia, and that is where the State Theater of Virginia happens to be. I think it's the crown jewel, artistic crown jewel of Virginia in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Great deal of theater, great deal of arts and crafts, music, bluegrass music from that region, country music down the road in Bristol, Virginia, and Tennessee is where it was first founded. Mm-hmm. All of those sort of things have made their way into my artistic worldview. Cy Twombly up the road in Lexington, Virginia. Sally Mann, the great photographer, also nearby. The great musician Ralph Stanley. Cinema really isn't represented in small town Virginia, at least not until now. But it was there that my love of theater began as a young actor. But the truth is, as a father of two young girls, both of whom love movies and love acting, I can see why actors now really become actors, because they want others, that they want people to pay attention to them. I mm-hmm. see it as children, and I see it now as adults. So perhaps it goes all the way back to my childhood.
How old
are
your girls?
Everything does. They are 9 and 12. My 9-year-old daughter Stella just starred as Annie in her local school production. Both of them were in the film Black Mass as two of Billy Bulger's 9 children. You see them at the parade because they were visiting while we were shooting. Mm-hmm. But they really love the world of acting. They really love the kind of carnival existence that a film director or an actor lives in, because you have a family for 6 or 8 or 10 weeks, the very 6, 8, 10 very intense weeks in which they get to meet the costume designer and the production designer and hair and makeup and other actors. And I only wish as a child that I'd had that experience. But perhaps had I had that experience, I wouldn't have gone into showbiz, because it's such a tough existence. But so far, so good. They love film. Once a month, we have at the Cooper household inappropriate movie night for my 9 and 12-year-old. And our recent selection was Schindler's List.
Well, some would say it's inappropriate. Some others would say it's educational.
That's exactly how, that's my wife and I thought the same thing. And they loved it. And it spurred a great deal of conversation, I can tell you that.
Well, you do, if I may. I'm not saying this as judgment. I'm saying this as approbation. But I mean, I think you're doing the right thing, because to me, the great joy of being a parent and a movie lover is passing on your love of movies to your kids and having conversations. So many people I meet never talk about movies. They see them, they kind of digest them like a McDonald's hamburger, and then they move on.
I tend to agree, and I wonder if it was that way when I was a child growing up in the 70s and 80s, because now we have so many different opportunities, whether it's, of course, it's Netflix at home, so many different television offerings, so many things at our fingertips, these phones that tend to occupy much of our time, that in a much less frenetic time, people really cared more about cinema. And I often wonder if that's because there's so many offerings for the populace. But, and I'm sure that's probably part of it, but it's unfortunate. But yes, through cinema do my kids and I explore all parts of the world, because I tend to watch a lot of world cinema.
Mm-hmm. What have you seen lately?
Well, unfortunately, all I've seen lately is Black Mass over and over, and a number of Q&As, but I really want to see Son of Saul. I really mm-hmm. want to see that picture, right. Which I'm told is mm-hmm. is quite good. But a film that struck me that I saw last year that as a parent that still stays with me is Thomas Vinterberg's The Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who haven't had a chance
with
to see
Mads
that.
Mads Mikkelsen.
Indeed, you should check that out. And I've just been spending a lot of time in Europe with the film,
mm-hmm.
Venice, San Sebastian, Zurich, London, and I get to meet many filmmakers whom I've long admired. So that's one of the great things about mm-hmm. taking a film around the world. So mm-hmm. many filmmakers that have influenced me.
Making the film seems to be the easy part now. Mm. Going out and promoting it, boy, that takes real stamina and determination.
Well, as Jeff Bridges said to me as we were doing this very same thing for Crazy Heart, he said, "Scott, we never worked this hard shooting the film." I said, "No, Jeff, we didn't." Little did I know that it would require this much time. But truly, when you're able to do this and you're able to take the film to all corners of the world, and certainly here in the United States, and help the film see a wider audience, because there are so many choices mm-hmm. for audiences to see, not only films, but everything else in their life, I'm certainly willing to do it, even though it can be tough at times. And certainly for a film like Black Mass, that maybe on the surface can be viewed simply as another gangster picture. But I can assure you that when I set out to make the film, and which I did with great trepidation, I didn't want to make simply a gangster picture.
What was your trepidation? That?
Well, there were many pitfalls in making this film. One, you're making a film in a genre in which, fair or not, inevitably you'll be compared to not only the other dramas of the year, but the best American films ever made.
Mm-hmm.
The work of Francis Coppola, the work of Sidney Lumet, the work of Martin Scorsese. And I'm learning through this process that Americans tend to like their gangsters with a nudge, nudge, and a wink, wink. And you don't quite get that in Johnny Depp's portrayal. It's mm-hmm. it's certainly an unrelenting look at a man who was a sociopath. So making a film in that genre was one. Making a film in Boston. There have been many, many films made of Boston in the last several years. Going back to the Friends of Eddie Coyle, which I think is a great film.
Mm-hmm.
And then also making a film in the 1970s and 80s, which has its own set of pitfalls, because I tend to find that most of those movies that are made very garishly designed and costumed and hairstyled, mm-hmm. and that tends to override characterization. So you have all of these reasons that your film can fail. One, you're going to be compared to the greatest films ever made, making a film in Boston in which everyone really scrutinizes the accents, and then you're making a film in the 1970s and 80s in which it's maybe the most difficult decades to make a film. But in the end, I said to Johnny Depp as I was rewriting the script, I said, "The truth is, I don't want to make a film about criminals who just happen to be humans. I want to make a film about humans who just happen to be criminals. And if we're going to make a film about James Whitey Bulger, who left so many indelible and deep emotional wounds in the city of Boston and many of its victims and victims' families, that we really have to do it in this unflinching and uncompromising manner. Otherwise, we will glamorize gangsters as they're so often glamorized.
Mm-hmm.
We will romanticize these men leading aspirational lifestyles that you often see gangsters lead." I said, "And in the end, the victims' families will think that we have trivialized what they've gone through and what they've endured, and I can't make that film." And he concurred, and off we went. And fortunately, we had a studio who essentially invented the gangster picture, but invented the gangster picture in the ways that I've just explained to you.
Right, and that being Warner Brothers.
Indeed, Warner Brothers, yes, in the 1930s. So they were fully supportive of my very authentic look at this world, in a world in which the truth often seems elusive and was elusive.
You made reference to the period detail and the period style. I, for one, am in love with Joel Edgerton's outfits in this movie. The vests, the collars, the ties, love them. And they didn't distract me. They just seemed right.
Well, I'm really glad that you said that, Leonard, because as I set out to make the film with all of my department heads, who were such talented filmmakers, I said to them, yes, we're making a film about 1975 through the 80s, but let's make a film as though it's a contemporary film and it happens to be 1975. In other words, everybody's work needs to be present and extremely detailed and meticulous, but all of that needs to recede into the background so that we feel it. But it's really all about characterization. So in terms of the costumes, Kasia Willicke-Mamone, who was the costume designer for my close friend Bennett Miller's work in Capote and Moneyball and Foxcatcher, I met with her. I've always loved her work and sense of detail and really telling the story through the characters. All of the suits that the FBI gentleman wore and all of Johnny Depp's costumes were handmade. As it turns out, all of the suiting was made by Barack Obama's tailor in Brooklyn. but we looked in terms of fabric, in terms of the width of the lapels, in terms of shirting, ties. Nothing was haphazard, and she worked in a very deep and meticulous manner in which to really help tell the story, because you see Joel's character in the very beginning as a rising FBI agent who wasn't making very much money, wearing very boxy suits, very bland, still extraordinarily well made because they're handmade. But then as he ascends the ranks of the FBI with the help of James Whitey Bulger and also becomes enriched because of his relationship to James Whitey Bulger, you'll realize, as his wife does in one particular scene, that he's changing, that his suiting's becoming flashier, that he's wearing more gold, that he begins to peacock more as, as an individual, all these sort of things that come through in very subtle characterization. And she was really, Kasia was remarkable with that.
That's great. I'm dating myself, but there's no avoiding it. I was married in the year 1975.
Wow.
And looking at my wedding photos, I can tell you, you're pretty authentic.
Oh, great. Well, oftentimes I watch that.
There wasn't a wedding scene that where the groom would have been wearing a frilly shirt, so perhaps just as well.
Oh, that's funny. That's great. Well, I'm happy that you noticed her work, because I often have a kind of an edict that no one sees our work. I don't quite like to feel the director's hand in films.
Oh, no, everybody says that, though. I mean, the cinematographers say, you know, it should be invisible. The costume designers say it should be invisible. And the composer says it should be invisible. And theoretically, that's true.
I really believe
that. You should just be involved in the movie. But if you're a sharp-eared moviegoer and you know, a real film buff, you're going to take note of these things. You know, the conscious and unconscious part of your brain digesting the movie or ingesting the movie, you're going to know.
Well, certainly for someone who's seen as many films as you, I mean, I can't imagine anyone off the top of my head who's probably seen as many movies as you in terms of what you do also as a
That's why I'm
teacher.
Drooling slightly, if you notice, yeah.
I mean, that's great. I wish that I had time to see that many.
certainly not when you're out on the promotional trail.
No, unfortunately. All I've have seen is this film. Over and over and over, apart from the nearly 1,000 times I've seen it prior to getting to this
that,
point.
That being the case, can you watch it and not want to make changes?
No. it's a little bit like, and I'll go back to my kids, it's a little bit like when my children were in preschool and they're coloring with their markers and the teacher eventually comes and says, pencils down, or she just takes them out of their hand. That's ultimately what happens. I take a very long time in post and tend to be overly meticulous to the point to where it drives even my wife nuts. Scott, haven't you locked the picture? And I'm up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about certain moments that can be extended or that can be tweaked, or how I might rearrange a scene or a particular, using a different lens size, all those sort of things that would drive you crazy. So in promoting the film and watching it over and over, and you see little things that you think, wow, I could have done this or that, it will drive you crazy.
Sorry about that.
No, well, it's
the mark of an artist.
Well, I don't know about
it's the mark of any artist, whether you're a writer or a painter or a sculptor or a filmmaker, seems to me.
Well, I haven't really gone back to watch Crazy Heart or Out of the Furnace since I promoted both of those films. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure when I do, it's always ooh, I should have done this. Oh, my.
You're always growing and changing an artist, and that's as it should be.
Yes, indeed. Just my third film, but I will continue to hopefully evolve.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you. We're going to take a little break, and then I want to come back and talk to you about working with actors because you've worked with so many outstanding – in this movie alone, but over the course of your brief but notable career, you've certainly – amassed an incredible roster of relationships with wonderful, wonderful actors. And you started as an actor yourself, so that we're going to get into that. And later, this is called billboarding, I think. Later, I've asked Scott to help me talk about a favorite unsung movie of his, and he chose a really interesting one. So that's a tease for you to stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, this is Baron Vaughn from Maltin' Movies at Baron Vaughn. Just wanted to tell you something that might be valuable to your earwolves. We've actually stocked up the Earwolf store with lots of stuff to wear, hang, and give this holiday season. I want you to know that each sale supports our show, Maltin' on Movies, and helps us employ a guy named Nick that ships all this stuff from a bunker in Los Angeles. He is a doomsday prepper, but that's beside the point. It also helps you be extra festive this holiday season. So support Earwolf by visiting earwolf.com, click shop, and get 10% off with the holiday code of holiday. Holiday is the code. Put the code in, and the code is holiday. And that's going to be good through December 11th. Thanks, and I love you.
Hello there, I'm Leonard Maltin. It's Maltin on Movies, and my guest today is filmmaker Scott Cooper, whose latest endeavor is Black Mass, which I'm sure many of you have already seen. And if you haven't, you should. Not just for Johnny Depp's starring performances, James Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston criminal, but for an amazing cast and a solid production all the way. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, Leonard. Lovely to be here.
Now, acting.
Mm.
When you started acting, got roles in some films and TV movies and such, what did you look for in your director? What did you want in terms of direction?
That he was listening, mm-hmm. that he cared about performance, because too often you see films in which actors just tend to be a necessary treatment for the film. pawns on a chessboard, mm-hmm. and you always want, or at least I did as a young actor, you wanted to be Travis Bickle, or you wanted to be challenged like Daniel Day-Lewis mm-hmm. In The Boxer, or you wanted to be Al Pacino in the Godfather sagas. And of course, very few people get those opportunities, but as a young actor, you're always dreaming for those until you realize that that may never come. Which is why you then pick up the pen to, as one of my close friends and mentors, Robert Duvall, would say, if you aren't living in the world you want to, create it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always revered actors, and actors that have moved me, actors that give performances that I think about days later, or months, or even years later. You know, it's an art form that I think moves people in ways that other art can't. And that's the really great performances. And that's really important to me as I make film. Not only what the film has to say, but how the actors perform either my writing or certainly in a way that makes the audience, when they leave, think about that particular performer or that character in ways that heretofore they hadn't.
Now, when you were a working actor, were there any directors that you took special note of, or you said to yourself, oh, this guy really is giving me what I need, what I want, and what I want to emulate?
Well, the one that I really most enjoyed working with was Walter Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter directed myself, and again, of course, Mr. Duvall and Thomas Hayden Church, among many others, in a Western called Broken Trail, which was AMC's first foray into television.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to watch both Robert Duvall and Walter Hill, who had worked together before, both watch Mr. Duvall as an actor, and then, of course, Walter Hill as a director, it really taught me a great deal about two men who were very confident in what they were doing and how they dealt with the crew and how they were so secure in telling the story that they didn't have to be showy. And I tend to be turned off by very showy filmmaking and very showy performances. So I would say that experience was really quite indelible, and was one of my last performances before I wrote Crazy Heart. So I hold it very fondly.
And you don't have to name names unless you want to. Were there directors that you work with that you said, I'm never going to be like that?
Well, there are directors who come to the set ill-prepared. And when they are ill-prepared, a sense of anxiety sets in. And that anxiety is contagious, and it infects the entire production. And then no one can do their best work. So as a film director, I really have this belief that if I'm not over-prepared, I'm under-prepared. So when I come to the set, I have worked many, many hours with my cinematographer in terms of camera placement, where we move the camera, how we move it, when we move it, lens selection, all those sort of things. So that, and I do that on the weekends before we're shooting, while in production, or for many hours during pre-production and then well into the night. And you have to have a DP, a cinematographer who will indulge you. And I happen to, in Masanobu Takenagi, who shot Out of the Furnace and Black Mass. So that when I come to the set, on a very technical level, this has been discussed ad nauseum. So I can spend all of my time working with the actors. Mm-hmm. I also learned on television shows or movies not to over-rehearse actors. In fact, I don't rehearse actors at all. We do a lot of investigative text work with the screenplay well before we start shooting, so that when they arrive at set, in between cut and when I call action again, is when we really do the definition, the real specific meticulous work on performance. And I find that if work is over-rehearsed, actors will make their choices in their trailers or in their hotel rooms the night before, and it seems to be pre-planned, and they're trying to hit certain beats mm-hmm. and moments and replicate those again. And I like the camera to really feel like it's capturing a moment for the very first time, and I want those performances to feel like they're capturing it for a very first time. So the truth is, I don't rehearse, and we spend a lot of time on the set really honing performance in. Mm-hmm. And I revere actors, especially actors that I want to make them feel safe. I want to make them feel that they can take big risks and fail, because it's striving for those indelible moments that you are going to fail. But if you don't go for those moments, you'll never have them. And I find performances don't feel alive. And I never want my performances in any of my films to feel inauthentic, because movie making is filled with artifice. And I want my films to unfurl in a way that you don't realize you're watching a film, because it's all about artifice. And I want all of that artifice stripped away. And I want that certainly to come through in performance.
Well, the word you use that resonates most with me is safe, feeling safe. That's what actors repeatedly say they hope for and they wish for on any movie set. And do you think the fact that you've been an actor helps enhance that feeling that they have?
No question. Again, you want to feel very comfortable and safe in a director's hand. You want to know that they're listening to you, that along with you as an actor, that they're helping you reach moments that you might not have thought about, mm-hmm. helping you better understand the character, helping you and the other actor or actors in the scene really bring it alive in a way that perhaps you hadn't thought about as you were memorizing your lines or really trying to get under the skin of a scene. But because I really understand that all actors have a different process, and that we actors are generally an insecure lot, mm-hmm. which is why we become actors in the first place, back mm-hmm. to being children who are quite insecure and want your family to pay it. Mom, dad, look at me, da-da-da-da-da, mm-hmm. and smiling and dancing. That's what we're still doing for mm-hmm. a living. So it's important to me that actors feel very safe. They can take these big risks. And because I understand the language of acting and understand what they're going through, because they're bearing their soul, hopefully for millions of people to see. And that lens will catch you if you're lying.
Well, how, when you have an ensemble as varied as, for instance, the one in Black Mass, these are actors of different disciplines, different backgrounds, different countries. You have Benedict Cumberbatch, who's a Brit, and Joel Edgerton, who's an Aussie, both playing Bostonians and doing a heck of a job. Talk about a tricky accent to nail, but they nailed it.
Well, they did nail it. The characters that they both, Benedict and Joel, are portraying are men that have been filmed quite a bit over the course of their career. Billy mm-hmm. Bulger is, of course, the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts, a very public figure who had an accent that was almost a put-upon accent, mm-hmm. almost Kennedy-esque, mm-hmm. Very patrician. He wore his erudition on his sleeve, and he wanted you to know that. Mm-hmm. So Benedict would just repeatedly watch over and over and over, along with his dialect coach, to get that accent just right. Joel Edgerton, on the other hand, would watch John Connolly as he was interviewed numerous times. And I'll tell a quick story. I invited Fred Wyshack, the prosecutor who brought Whitey Bulger and the Winter Hill Gang down, to visit the set, because as I was shaping the screenplay, I spent a lot of time with him. And I invited him to watch a scene in which the man portraying him, Corey Stahl, has a scene with Joel Edgerton, which Joel Edgerton comes in, introduces himself, offers him tickets to go see Roger Clemens pitch in Fenway Park. He's watching over and over and over, and I ask him, I say, so what do you think of Corey Stahl? And he says, Scott, he's incredible. He has less hair than I have, but he's great. He said, but who is that guy playing John Connolly? Is he from South Boston? I said, no, he's from Australia. He said, Scott, let me tell you, for 20 years, I have tried to put that man in prison, and he looks just like him. He moves just like him, and his accent is perfect. I can't even believe it, how uncanny it is.
Wow. You couldn't get a higher compliment.
No, you couldn't. And the same thing happened when James Whitey Bulger's attorney, Jay Carney, visited the set, which was a little unnerving. I said to Johnny, I said, you know, Whitey Bulger's attorney's here, and he wants to watch. How do you feel about that? Johnny said, well, I don't care. I said, okay. So he's watching a shoot. And at the end of the day, I introduced myself, and I had noticed that he was watching the monitor, and he was shaking his head. And I said, did we just not get it right? And he said, no. He said, Scott, it's as though a specter has come into this church. He said, Johnny's eyes, the way he looks, the way he talks, his voice, his physicality, he said, it's unremarkable how he's captured him. And Johnny only had the surveillance footage that you see at the end of the movie from the mm-hmm. FBI. Mm-hmm. He really only had that to go off of. So when I had those two men compliment the performers in the ways in which they did, I knew we were on the right path.
Now, Johnny Depp wouldn't be the first name that would come to mind.
Which is why I cast him.
Elaborate, please.
Well, Johnny is probably one of the two or three most famous people in the world, and I'm not sure who number one is, and most recognizable. Mm-hmm. He looks nothing like James Whitey Bulger. Mm-hmm. He also plays characters in which he is always very likable or that we empathize with. I mean, it'd be hard-pressed for you, Leonard, to name an actor who has left more indelible characters on the screen as an American actor, from Edward Scissorhands to Jack Sparrow to Dead Man to Willy Wonka. On and on and on, Hunter S. Thompson and George Young and Donnie Brasco and now James Whitey Bulger. Johnny can do comedy. He can do drama. Most actors can't do both and do them both well. But because he's such a likable guy and he's so soulful and he's a very generous and kind man, I said to Johnny, I've never seen the kind of danger in your work that I need to see from James Whitey Bulger. You're also a very expressive actor, and this is a man that we see in that FBI surveillance that's very economical. He's very, very confident in his physicality. He's a man that if Leonard, you and I are having a conversation, casual conversation, we stand about 18 inches apart. I said, Johnny, notice how Whitey Bulger would stand 12 inches apart from us with his arms crossed. And notice how he doesn't move much in the FBI's frame. And notice how he doesn't blink much, because blinking – conveys indecision and a man who isn't in control of his thoughts, and it shows weakness. And the only time that Whitey Bulger shows weakness in this film, and the only time that he shows that he isn't in control, is when his son is dying because he can't control his health. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, makes him spiral. I said, I've never seen any of this from you. That's why I want you. And after many hours of conversation, Johnny agreed that that's what the role required, and he knew that he was going to have to go to places that physically and emotionally he'd never gone to. And what you get on screen, I think, couldn't be further from who the man is. Too often, I see performances that I think are great, really beautifully rendered, but I know that's a part of that person's DNA. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. James Whitey Bulger does not exist anywhere inside Johnny Depp. And that makes it all the more mesmerizing from one of our national treasures.
I want to ask about another actor you know pretty well, Robert Duvall. You mentioned him already. You've worked alongside him, and you've also directed him. When you first worked with him, what did you observe? Now, here's a guy who's been doing it for a long time and has never lost his – obviously has never lost his zeal or his desire to give the best performance he can. I'm thinking of particularly of Get Low, which is a wonderful performance and an awfully good movie.
I would say, and this is not an overstatement, there's probably no one that has been more of an artistic influence on me than Robert Duvall. It's a man that I speak to, if not every day still, and I've known him now 14 years, was married on his farm. Every day he calls to talk about, well, for instance, today we talked about what happened in Paris. And then the conversation will move into something that he's watched. He's in his mid-80s. This is a man who watches film every day and can't get enough of it. And what I most learned from him when I first saw him, and then when I directed him in Crazy Heart, and then just in my very long collaborative process with him, an artistic exploration, is a man who, in all facets of his life, tells the truth. And that's what great acting is. Stripping away artifice, really putting forth a strong emotional and psychological acuity that comes across in his performances in the most unshowy manner possible. And that has translated into my how I construct my films in hopefully a very invisible way, the way in which I edit, the way in which I move the camera, the way in which I direct the mise-en-scene, the way in which I use music and lighting, all those sort of things to put together a film in a very unshowy way, because I was watching a master who's so in control, Mr. Duvall, in his instrument that he made it look effortless. But I also realized, and the same thing was with Jeff Bridges or Christian Bale in my last film, and certainly with Johnny and many others in this film, that there's a difference between being a little bit talented, as I thought I was as an actor, and then watching those men who are gifted. And there are few people who are really gifted like that. And Mr. Duvall is at the very top of the list. So to see him with extreme confidence give such truthful performances, and for a man who's so generous, as I find Johnny and Jeff and Christian to be, off screen helping another actor when the camera's literally right behind their right or left ear and their face is not on screen, but giving them everything they need to get the most out of them as a performer. It's only few people do that.
Did he affect you as an actor when you were still
Indeed,
acting?
He did, because we would often do improvisational exercises. And he would say to me, Scott, and I often use this with my actors, never have an idea where you're going to go in the scene. You should be so attuned to the other actor and know this character and the material so well that it should feel as though everything you're saying just came to you. Mm-hmm. And that also takes a great deal of onus off you're having to express yourself and show mom and dad, see, all those years that I didn't go to med school or law school, watch me act. It's the complete opposite of that. It's really doing what you and I are doing here, Leonard, which is just talking and listening and really being connected on an emotional level. And I learned that a great deal from him, and he was always very supportive. He really liked my work as an actor, and we worked two or three times together. because you want, great actors are, it appears effortless. It's like that swan that's gliding across mm-hmm. the pond that looks so elegant above the water, but below you really see them working. And Robert Duvall's that way. And Jeff Bridges, it's uncanny to see men who are so, or actors who are so in control of their instrument. I really yearn to work with actors that I've long admired, like Kate Blanchett or Meryl Streep or mm-hmm. Kate Winslet. Or there's so many other, Carey Mulligan, young actresses that I mm-hmm. really think are doing just outstanding work that I can't wait to work with them. My films have been male dominated, but Maggie Gyllenhaal was excellent in Crazy Heart.
Yes, she was.
And truly gives a very emotionally rich performance. And was so connected to the material in Jeff. So I've learned from all of these actors, and it started on that first time on Gods and Generals, this Civil War epic mm-hmm. in which Robert Duvall played General Robert E. Lee, mm-hmm. to whom he's related distantly, mm-hmm. That I learned at the feet of a master. Mm-hmm. And then having him produce Crazy Heart, and as I was presenting both my first cut to Mr. Duvall and Jeff Bridges, that's an unnerving time, I can tell you.
I can imagine.
Yes. Yeah, I've learned so much from these men.
Now, I learned something from Robert Duvall that may not be quite as profound or helpful, except in a certain specific circumstance. I interviewed him last time I interviewed him was at South by Southwest, the festival in Austin, Texas, and he went on at great length with enormous passion about the best places to get brisket.
He's a gourmand.
Yes. I mean, he really – I mean, if you want to know about brisket, ask Robert Duvall.
He loves food. Much of our conversation will revolve around world politics or mm-hmm. local politics, sports. Mm-hmm. He loves soccer. Mm-hmm. His wife's Argentinian. Mm-hmm. He also loves pro and college football. And around movies, and he sees everything, and is just so driven by the truth mm-hmm. and truthful filmmaking and truthful mm-hmm. acting. Mm-hmm. It's so rewarding to see a man who has, I'm sure, made over 100 films, and has been doing it as long as he has, to continue to want to do it. Mm-hmm. Or you look at Clint Eastwood, or you look mm-hmm. at Ridley Scott, mm-hmm. George Miller. Men who are putting out extremely fine work, even at for men who've made many films and been doing it for a long time.
Yep.
I hope I have that same passion and zeal to making film when I'm their age.
Eat well.
Indeed. And wear comfortable shoes.
Yes, exactly. Yes. All right. We'll take another short break and then come back for our final segment where we will reveal, or Scott will reveal, his choice of unsung movie. A film that you really ought to see if you don't know it already. We'll be right back. Hi there. I'd like you to know about my latest book. It's the new third edition of Leonard Maltin's Classic Movie Guide, presented by Turner Classic Movies. In it, you'll find essential information and capsule reviews of 10,000 movies made from the silent era up through 1965, with 300 new entries for this edition. If you or someone you love enjoys watching vintage movies on TCM, DVD or Blu-ray at home, this book was created with you in mind. Whether your taste runs to silent films, Alfred Hitchcock thrillers, Marx Brothers comedies, or gems of European cinema, you'll find what you're looking for in these pages. And if you own an earlier edition, please know that we've made hundreds of corrections and changes, as well as beefing up our inventory with 300 brand new listings. TCM presents Leonard Maltin's Classic Movie Guide, now available at bookstores everywhere and online booksellers too. I hope you'll give it a try. Thanks. Hello again. It's Leonard Maltin. This is Maltin on Movies, and our guest today, my guest today, it's not our guest, it's my guest today. Damn it, it's mine. He's mine. His name is Scott Cooper. He's a very talented writer and director, and you may have seen Crazy Heart, which earned Jeff Bridges his first and, his long overdue Academy Award as Best Actor.
Indeed.
And also, Out of the Furnace with Christian Bale and Woody Harrelson, Casey Affleck, Forrest Whitaker, Willem Dafoe, an amazing cast, Sam Shepard, Zoe Saldana. You choose good people. And latest, Black Mass, which has an equally impressive ensemble. And now I'm not going to tease anymore. I asked Scott to come up with a film that he would choose as one of his favorites. I won't say the favorite, because that's too hard. for somebody who's a real movie buff, but asked him to name a film that he likes that he thinks is perhaps undervalued. And you said?
I said Funny Bones by Peter Chelsom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it came out, correct me if I'm wrong, in 1995?
Yep, 20 years old.
Wow. I still think about that film often. Oliver Platt, Jerry Lewis, wonderful British comic who gives a performance that I think is one of the all-time great screen performances named Lee Evans. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Lee's doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think Leslie Caron's mm-hmm. in it. And it tells the story of a man in Oliver Platt who is a failed American comic who has been struggling with his act.
He has the misfortune of being the son of a really popular, much-loved comedian played by Jerry Lewis.
Who is remarkable in the film.
Yes.
So as he's failing, he decides to go to, of all places, Blackpool, England, where his father, Jerry Lewis, was a child comic and had great success. And Oliver Platt's character goes back to Blackpool to see if he can find that comic genius and reignite it in himself. And as he does, it unfurls all of these familial secrets that Jerry Lewis contains, in which he has a son, played by Lee Evans, that is a monstrously funny comic. And the film is endearing, it's quirky, it's tragic, it's heartbreaking, and it's utterly memorable. And I think of it often. I just recently had the good fortune to meet the great Robert De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he was preparing to play a comedian who was a legendary comedian in a film called The Comedian. And I said, Mr. De Niro, you have to see this film. It's called Funny Bones, and it's one of Oliver Platt's greatest performances, Jerry Lewis, on and on and on, and he hadn't heard of it. And as it turns out, so many people haven't heard of this film, and I can't understand why, because it's something that I think about all the time. Someone who struggles under the weight of a parent who also happened to be, as you said, mm-hmm. pointed out, an incredible comic, living with that type of legacy, but also someone who has – I guess it's writer's block or it's comedy mm-hmm. block, and who can't express himself and who tries to find it in other people and perhaps steal other people's ideas. It has quite a bit of humor as well. But it's extremely touching and it's moving. I think Peter Chelsom is a film director of a lot of heart
mm-hmm.
and a lot of humanity. And for anyone who hasn't seen this film, it's called Funny Bones by Peter Chelsom, 1995. How did you review it?
You know, I gave it a somewhat mixed review because I love things about it. To me, the parts are greater than the whole, but those parts are great.
They are, indeed.
But use the word quirky, and that's an appropriate adjective.
Eccentric.
It's an odd movie. It's even a peculiar movie, but it's endearingly peculiar, which is why I think it sticks with you.
Indeed. It's funny. I find the films that oftentimes are given mixed reviews mm-hmm. like that to be the ones that I find to be the most interesting.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know if it was Francis Coppola who said that if everybody likes your film, it's likely not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that whether it's that movie or it's Ridley Scott's Matchstick Men or
another one I like with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. Or if you haven't seen this French film by Laurent Canté called L'Emploi du Temps, which translates to Time Out. I think it may have won the Palme d'Or in 2001. It's an extraordinary film about a man who loses his job. And his family doesn't know it, yet he gets up every day and puts on his suit and takes his kids to school. And, of course, they think he's going to work, mm-hmm. but he isn't. And there's this, as Raymond Chandler would say, there's a dirty secret behind every palm tree in Los Angeles. There's one in Time Out. So see that as well. But I urge you to see Funny Bones if you haven't seen that, or Matchstick Men.
Matchstick Men is awfully good.
Or Time Out.
Matchstick Men is certainly one of the most unusual credits for director Ridley Scott. We don't think of him doing lighthearted material. And though there's a dark side to Matchstick Men, it certainly isn't a heavy film.
No, it isn't. But that's what I like about it,
yeah.
is that you have a director who's known for a certain type of film, mm-hmm. and you know when you see a Ridley Scott in Imprimatur that you're going to get this certain type of film, but you see it and it's delightful.
Mm-hmm.
And an incredible performance by Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell mm-hmm. and Alison Lohman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are movies that, again, I don't know how well that was reviewed, but probably mixed.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, those are films that really stay with me. Funny Bones, Time Out, Matchstick Men, Terrence Malick's New World, Dancer in the Dark, which is a very odd Lars von Trier film.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, when I make films, because there are so many other things we could be doing with our time, I never want people to leave the theater on a Friday night, and by the time their head hits the pillow, they have forgotten what they've seen.
Mm-hmm.
You want to make films that have indelible moments, shards that maybe people will think about on Saturday after they've seen it Friday night or Sunday or Monday or Tuesday. And those films that I've just mentioned will hit me at the oddest times, certain moments. And I think that's why I became a lover of cinema and then ultimately a film director, or Robert Duvall in Tender Mercies, in which one of the few times that he sings in the film, he does it with his back to the camera. And we don't need to see him. I mean, it's genius. Who else would do that? And what other director would not want to cover that and have Robert Duvall singing right mm-hmm. to the lens? All of those kind of moments that really inspire me to, as I'm writing, mm-hmm. as I'm thinking about what film I might make next, certain performers. You were talking about cast earlier. I recall watching Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman doing really exquisite work. But I turned to my wife in the theater and I said, "Who's that young guy playing Phil Hoffman's son?" She didn't know, because we didn't watch Friday Night Lights. I haven't seen Breaking Bad, so I didn't realize it was Jesse Plemons, mm-hmm. who now is in my film. Young actor that I think is one of the best of his generation, 25 or 26. And it's those sort of small moments that you remember as a film director. You think, "Oh my gosh, I really want to use that actor." Or, "Wow, Julianne Nicholson had some really great moments in August Osage County," or having seen her on stage in Sam Shepard's Heartless, or Rory Cochrane, who mm-hmm. plays Steve Fleming in my film. All these actors, character actors that look like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's as opposed to people who look like movie stars. And I find those, for the most part, to be less interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I like to cast a lot of non-actors, and these movies that are underappreciated often have those kind of actors like Oliver Platt or
right.
Jerry Lewis
right.
or Lee Evans.
Mm-hmm.
Lee, where are you? If you're listening, call me. You're amazing.
He is.
Incredible.
He is. People may have seen him. People may remember him from There's Something About Mary, because that was such a big hit movie. And he played the man who quixotically was pretending to be disabled.
Yes.
He had crutches and his body was all
That's
twisted.
Right. Well, he's an extreme physical comedian.
Yeah.
Which tells me that whoever directed that happened to have seen Funny Bones. And it was probably, if I'm guessing, that film, Something About Mary, came out in probably 96 mm-hmm. or 97 after someone saw him in Funny Bones, because he's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Real talent.
Oh, I mean, one of the great one-off performances I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, As a writer, what's it like submitting your script to Sam Shepard, who is in the cast?
Oh, boy.
Unnerving.
I mean, Sam is, you know, one of our great writers. And I'll never forget, I submitted it to him with a letter. And I was in New York. And his agent called me. And she said, "Scott, you're going to get a call from Sam Shepard today." I said, "Has he read the script?" She said, "Well, let him tell you, he wants to call you. He's going to be calling you from Paris." I thought, "Oh my God, how romantic, how great is this?" And I'm not lying. So I'm walking from where I was staying down by the Mystery Bookshop, which is no longer there, on Bleecker Street. And there's a photographic book with Sam Shepard on the cover that I think was shot by Bruce Weber. And I couldn't believe this. So I'm walking in the village, my phone rings, and Sam Shepard says, "Is this Scott?" And I said, "It is." Of course, I see the numbers as European. He said, "This is Sam Shepard." He said, "Titles are some of the most important things to an artist's work. And Out of the Furnace is one hell of a title. I'm in." And I said, "My God," I said, "Sam, that's, you know, that means so much to me, from a man whose plays have moved me and whose writing is indelible. And, what'd you think of the script?" He said, "Well, I love the script. I love the part. I love that it feels very personal," which it was to me. It was probably my most personal screenplay. And he said, "I love titles that reveal themselves over the course of the narrative." He said, "Too often you'll see someone or you'll see a film that the title, and it tells you everything about the film. And I find those to be uninteresting." He also says, I hate films in which some asshole, excuse my language, that's what he said, has to announce the title. He said, so I really love that that was very subtle, but it also had a lot of power, and that meant a lot to me because I was asked a couple of times by the financier to change the title to something less esoteric or less enigmatic. Mm-hmm. And of course, Christian Bale said, absolutely not, because he also happened to really love that title. But to have Sam Shepard read one of your screenplays is very unnerving, to say the least, and then to have him see the resultant film. But it couldn't have been a better experience. And for a film that was very little seen, I've never had more people around the world as I'm taking this film out to tell me how much they appreciated that film and how it stayed with them. So whether your movie gets seen on opening weekend or not, hopefully they have long shelf lives.
Well, now they do.
Indeed.
Now they do. There is no longer the elephant's burial ground for movies that slip through the cracks.
No, it's changing. That's right. My children.
Of course, still, you all want them to see films in a theater. That's the ideal.
And oh, indeed.
The ultimate way to see and appreciate it.
For me, the only way.
Yeah. But if you missed it in the theaters, now at least they don't disappear.
No, my kids don't really watch television. All they watch is Netflix. Mm-hmm. And they have their own queue, and they just – that's mm-hmm. that's how they view the world. And it's interesting. They have that at their fingertips. I mean, as a child, and I'm sure with you, it took forever to see things. And then I had to educate myself with Laserdisc and VHS. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks ago, I just went to the Arrow Theater again to see Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. To remind me what a genius Orson mm-hmm. Welles was at 25.
That film never disappoints.
Oh, my gosh. I'll say.
I see something new every time I watch that film.
Well, you see, great films are that way. Whether it's The Conversation, which I watched again for like the 40th time, with great films, with repeat viewing, something is always revealed that you missed mm-hmm. or is in a much deeper way. And too often I find movies that are either overly lauded by film critics or by those who determine what might win awards, mm-hmm. that upon repeated viewings, just the opposite happens.
Yeah.
And I can't quite understand that. But, well, I guess if Hitchcock or Kubrick never won an Oscar, then, you know, what does it all mean, Leonard?
What does it all mean? Well, we won't even attempt to answer that question right now.
No.
Scott, thanks so much for coming by today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you here. And again, I'll recommend Black Mass if you haven't seen it yet. What are you waiting for? And I want to tell you that you can find me, as usual, at Leonard Maltin on Twitter, online at leonardmaltin.com. And I'm going to take the chance one more time. I've been imposing upon you listeners by telling you that I have 4 of my older books back in print on Kindle, Amazon Kindle. And if you go to my author page on Amazon, it'll lead you there. So thanks for listening. We hope to see you again next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Here's 5 reasons to listen to Who Charted.
Number 5, Howard.
It sounded fantastic. It sounded big and bombastic.
Number 4, Cool Up.
Oh, my God.
Number 3, Starred.
Are that you serious?
Don't wait. What?
Number 2.
Guest.
And my real name is not Kether Donahue. I'm in the Witness Protection Program.
Number 1, the charts.
If they could keep this promise that it really was the last witch hunter, I might be interested.
Check out Who Charted every Wednesday at earwolf.com or your favorite podcast app.
Charts.
Pop.
Pop?
Pop.
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 Pop. Pop.
This has been a Wolf Pop production. Executive produced by Paul Scheer, Adam Sachs, Chris Bannon, and Matt Gourley. For more information and content, visit wolfpop.com.